Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press star one. During the question-and-answer session, we will request that you say your name, organization, and state, please. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Alicia Downs. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's COCA conference call entitled Mental Health in Disasters and Other Crises. We are very excited to have Dr. Mark Safran present on this call. Dr. Safran is a career medical officer in the United States Public Health Service and a graduate of CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service Training Program. He is currently CDC's longest-serving psychiatrist. Dr. Safran's work has addressed a wide range of cross-cutting public health challenges, including infectious and chronic diseases, suicide, and public health emergencies. And for many years, he has led efforts to incorporate attention to mental health and disease into CDC's public health efforts. We'll be using a PowerPoint presentation for this call that you should access from our website. If you've not already downloaded the presentation, please go to www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on Conference Call Information, Summaries, and Slide Sets, and you can find the PowerPoint there. In compliance with continuing education requirements, presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled products or products under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and the presenters for this seminar do not have financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not involve the unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use, and there is no commercial support. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Safran. You may begin.
Thank you, Alicia, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you all for joining us for today's call. I'd like you to go to the title slide now, and I'm going to ask for your help in making this an interactive session. Although you won't be able to talk during the first half of the session, I need you to actually, on each slide is designed to basically encourage you to think about a particular concept and how it might relate to your particular situation and role in an actual crisis or disaster. And so when you're looking at these slides, I want each of you to jot down at least one point next to each slide. And if we move on to the ground rules now, that next slide, you'll see that I'm going to basically present for the first half, but I consider this really an interactive and joint presentation among all of us. So the second half of the presentation will be all of you sharing ideas and basically sharing either experiences that your organization has had and that you want to share with others for advice and guidance, or just challenges that you'd like to pose to others, and also sharing new things that you've thought of during the course of this call that maybe you hadn't thought of before regarding how mental health may impact upon your role in an actual crisis or your organization's role. So that said, one other thing I want to make clear is that in order to make this work, and because we want to have an open dialogue and we want to encourage thinking outside the box, no one is bound to limit themselves to statements or views that are approved by their organization. And these slides that I'm sharing and anything I'm going to say isn't necessarily approved by CDC Public Health Service or Department of Health and Human Services or the U.S. government. So I want this to be a clear, open discussion. And moving on to the objective slide, what I'd like everyone to try to focus on is, and over the course of the presentation, I'd like each of you to try to write down at least a couple of examples of how mental health and or mental illness may impact the outcomes of disasters and other crises, and also to identify at least one aspect of your own organization's emergency planning or an organization that you're familiar with that may not adequately take into account issues related to mental health. And finally, I want you to consider a strategy that you can use in your professional role to be able to recognize and respond to issues related to mental health. And particularly, you're not going to be able to respond to or recognize all of the issues. No one will. But the idea is to have some kind of strategy that will remind you to remember to at least consider and look for these issues. So moving on to the next slide. We talk about mental health all the time, but it's important to just think for a second about what mental health is. And there are many definitions. The Surgeon General has defined in the past mental health to be a successful performance of mental functions in terms of thought, mood, and behavior. And it's noted that mental health results in productive activities, fulfilling relationships, and ability to adapt and to cope. I want you to look at this slide really carefully and think about that, because ultimately, in any crisis or disaster, not only will the impact of the crisis or disaster upon the people in the population that you're trying to help be impacted by mental health, but your own, I mean, all of us, each of us has mental health, each of us will in some way be impacted. And each of the people that we work with and each of our colleagues and organizations' abilities to respond will be impacted by mental health. Sometimes it will be impacted in positive ways, sometimes in negative ways. But if we're not thinking about that, we can totally miss an important part of the picture. So I want you to think for a second about how mental health has or might impact your organization in a crisis. Now, moving on to the next slide, mental disorders. Mental disorders are specific conditions. They're medical conditions that have been defined over time and that actually are health conditions just like any other illness, and that are often treatable, very treatable. But what I want you to think about here is what impact mental disorders can have, particularly if they're not treated or not adequately treated. And so there are many definitions of mental disorders, but right here we'll just think of mental disorders as health conditions characterized by alterations in thinking, mood, or behavior that are associated with distress and or impaired functioning. Think about that and think about how basically experiencing symptoms of a mental illness an impact upon your organization's response, any individual's response or an organization's response. Think about how it could impact on the people who are being exposed also to the crisis or disaster. So those are key points. And there is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that details specific mental disorders, and many of them are familiar with depression, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, many others. Now we're moving on to the next slide. The prevalence of mental disorders in the United States has also been widely estimated at a variety of different figures. Well, from the Surgeon General's report on mental health, we'll use that number that was arrived at, and it's basically 1 in 4 Americans in any given year will have a mental illness if you include alcohol and substance abuse. If you don't include alcohol and substance abuse, it's 1 in 5. But either way, you're talking a large segment of the population. So again, and this may seem really basic, but when you're planning your organizations or your personal response to helping in a crisis or a disaster, are you thinking about the fact that 1 in 4 of the people that you're going to be trying to help has a mental illness and how that might impact? I know you're going to be considering the fact that 1 in 4 people in your organization probably have a mental illness. And now the fraction of people, we'll go on to the next slide. Another thing that probably many of us are not thinking about is the fact that it's estimated that about 2/3 of people with mental illness do not seek treatment. So how will that impact upon the crisis and the people being exposed to it, and how will that impact on your organization's response? And this is a real tragedy, because mental illnesses are treatable, and most people most people will benefit from, at least in some way, from treatment. And so it's in non-disaster times it's important, and disaster times becomes even more important. Now, moving on again, the next slide. There's a picture of the brain that you're looking at right now. And this is to remind all of us that the brain is a very complex system. It's a very complex organ, just like any other organ. But yet, we tend to neglect that aspect of health that deals with, that involves the brain. And so, in a crisis, this becomes even more important because everyone's brain is affected differently by stress, and everyone's brain is affected differently also by things that disrupt the normal routine. I mean, think for a second about your own normal routine and think about what things that you might end up doing or not doing in a crisis that might impact on your ability to carry out your emergency roles as best as you can. And then think about that for everyone else. Now, the next slide shows a picture of a large number of medications, pills. And that's to remind us that medications, they're just one part of treatment for some mental illnesses. But there's, for people who are taking medicines that have helped to stabilize their illness and that are doing well with their medicines, what's going to happen in a disaster or emergency when people may no longer be able to access the medicines either at the pharmacy, or they may not be able to get refill prescriptions because communication is down? What will happen? And think of think of how that might impact even some of your own team that you're counting on to respond. So, and this is a very tricky issue here because, you know, on the one hand, you know, we have concern that sometimes people prescribe too many medicines, and you have medicines that people overdose on because they have these huge, people, you know, may have huge supplies of medicines that just sit. Also, they may get diverted. But the problem is that lots of people who are responsible about the medicines and would never misuse them or wouldn't attempt suicide or would never sell them to anyone else. Lots of people basically, you know, because we're so cautious, we keep everyone to exactly the amount of medicine they need till the next visit. What happens in an emergency when maybe they can't get medicine now for 2 weeks? So maybe they would have handled it okay, but now we've created a separate emergency for that person because no more medicine. So again, this is just one example. I'm trying to, for this part of the call, just harp on some really basic examples that are just meant to get you thinking about how these things impact you. Now, if you look at HIV/AIDS, the next slide, the reason I have this slide up there is to remind us that we're giving out public health information all the time for any disease. And in a crisis or a disaster, we'll often set up our hotlines and websites to give out information to help people through that crisis. We've learned in the past from various experiences, particularly our experience with the National HIV/AIDS hotline back in the 1990s, which was the largest public health hotline in the world, that we can't exclude mental health. We can't just neglect it in giving out information. And at that time, that was an information hotline. And because it wasn't a counseling hotline, it was just an information hotline, it was thought that it was okay to not train the people staffing the call in how to work with people with mental illness or with mental health needs, or how to refer people for mental health help. And so that wasn't done, and there were problems. The hotline wasn't handling the calls well. And it turned out that about 12% of the calls, when we evaluated, turned out to be mental health related, and the staff handling the calls were having a hard time because they weren't trained. So when we added that training, it made a big difference, and it basically helped the people who were handling the calls to feel better about the work. And it was, you know, basically, you look at that way, 12% of 1.5 million calls a year were now being handled with people who knew how to handle those calls. So basic point, again, something that you would think everyone would have thought of, but even in a big hotline like that, which was one of the best in the world, we thought that was something we missed. So something to think about in your emergency planning and hotlines. Next slide is about, it shows some reminders back from the anthrax crisis, and it's to remind us that when terrorism happens, it can take any form, but oftentimes one of the biggest ways that terrorism will impact everyone is the emotional effects on people. Of course, it will kill people, and it's very dangerous, and that's a huge, I mean, obviously we're trying to contain whatever, we're trying to protect the population against terrorism, but we also have to keep in mind that the mental health impact is huge, and anthrax fortunately did not reach the whole population, but it created havoc and fear across the country, even for those who were not killed and did not have loved ones who were killed. So think about how we're going to handle the mental health piece of the next crisis. The next slide that we move to is there only to remind you, it's about adult domestic violence, and it's to remind you that, usually we think about crises and disasters as big things affecting huge numbers of people, but sometimes they can be big things affecting just a family or one or two people, and domestic violence is just an example of how oftentimes these are public health issues that are off our radar screen, and at one time only half of all medical students in the U.S. and Canada were ever even trained about adult domestic violence formally, and that was a big issue. So the point is, any issue could be a big issue and could become exacerbated in a crisis. The next slide deals with suicide clusters, another type of crisis, and one of the things that's clear in suicide clusters is that oftentimes they go unnoticed initially because people aren't looking for them or don't want to notice them, and then when they are noticed, often people don't know how to deal with it, what to do next, and sometimes some of the things that people do to respond to these actually make them worse, and suicide clusters are just one example of where the way that we communicate our messages can be very important if we're to avoid actually further traumatizing populations and actually exacerbating the contagion of the problem. My next slide is to remind us of hurricanes and the more devastating on a large scale across wide areas, that type of disasters that do that. And to think about in those situations and those of us who've been out, responding to the aftermath of a hurricane, we know that all of the systems that we count on, or most of them, are knocked out. And so the question is, what certain things that people count on, whether it's the mental health system or just routine healthcare, may not be available. So what do we do, and just who will we talk to? Now, the next slide is to bring us back to sort of a peaceful, tranquil, regular, everyday setting today or any day, just when there's no disaster going on in your community. This is the time to be thinking about who are the people that are going to come together, in the face of a disaster. I know that as clinicians interested in emergency response, you all know this, but how many of you actually know who all the key mental health players are that you would involve in your disaster response or in your response to the emergency? And really what I want to encourage is for everyone to think about who those players are. And don't just know one, because you never know. In a disaster, that person or that organization could be out of commission for whatever reason. So now is the time to be going to lunch with the folks that you'd be working with in mental health, getting to know them, getting to understand about their part, because if you're not a mental health expert, you may not be able to necessarily figure out how to address every single mental health problem that's going to come. You probably can't, but at least if you can learn to recognize and refer, or at least consult an emergency, that's going to help a lot. Now, in terms of resources, there are lots of resources out there. The next slide just gives you the CDC mental health website. It gives some links to some very helpful or some actually interesting public and private sector websites. And then the next slide after that is includes some resources from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is the lead mental health services agency in our country. And SAMHSA shared with me these web addresses that that may be helpful to you in a crisis. One of them gives information actually about state mental health coordinators. I'll be talking a little bit more about those in a minute. And there's information about other resources. But also, SAMHSA contracts with private services to provide a national suicide hotline and also a treatment referral hotline. In addition, the SAMHSA website and also the CDC website has links to this. Gives links to actual list of mental health resources in the state. So these are starting points. Keep in mind that the hotline numbers I give you, from time to time, it's possible they could change just because they are privately contracted hotlines. So you periodically may want to just check the SAMHSA website and make sure there have been no changes there. But these numbers have been in existence for a while. The next slide is about state and territorial disaster mental health coordinators. And these, every state is a little bit different. Some states have a very active state or territorial disaster mental health coordinator and actually have a very active state mental health authority, which the coordinator may be part of in some states. And in such states, the state mental and behavioral health managers and coordinators, they will actually partner with other statewide emergency response professionals, and they'll be involved in the exercises, and they'll actually be part of the plan for the response. And SAMHSA actually, that's a SAMHSA program, the state mental health coordinators in that. SAMHSA gives mentoring to them, but each individual state makes its own decision as to what role these will play and what level of support. But these would be key people certainly to talk to and be aware of in your state. And the next slide is meant as a challenge slide. It actually doesn't include all of, it's not meant to include all of the key people that you need to know in your local area. But here's just a couple of examples of key mental health resources that you might want to be aware of. And certainly the Red Cross often plays a big role in mental health emergency response that local hospitals may, local emergency services, and a lot more. And so the question is, who are those players in your community and in your state? And would you know how to get in touch with them in a crisis? Now, moving on to the next slide, I want you to be thinking now, when you're assessing a situation in a crisis or any kind of disaster, and you're figuring out whether it's in your local, whatever organization you're part of, whether you're a clinician in a private practice, whatever role you're playing, when you're assessing a disaster or crisis situation, are you thinking about mental health as a part of that? And what I want each of you to sort of come up with a way that you can remind yourself to include mental health in that assessment, and to basically to also know how you're going to try to get help if possible. If you get into a mental health situation that's beyond what you have the expertise to address, but really, at this point, I think each of you will have your own unique situation and your own unique experience. And I thought I would do something, as I mentioned in the beginning, that's different than what we usually do in these calls, and that I really thought that rather than me talking for the whole hour, I thought it would be much better to use the second half to actually have each of you share, you know, we all share with each other some ideas. So I'd like to refer you back to the objective slide, back near the beginning, and it's the one that basically reviews those objectives. And so I want you now, when we open up the phone lines, to come forward with examples, unique examples that people may not have thought of, or ones that were really important to you, or ones that you've just thought of about how mental health and or mental illness may impact the outcomes of disasters and other crises. And also, when you've been writing down those aspects of your own organization's emergency planning that may not adequately take into account issues related to mental health, now's the time to share them. And also, if there are any particular strategies that you've found helpful professionally to help you to recognize and respond to issues related to mental health. Keep in mind, what's right for one person or one organization or state won't necessarily be right for another. So these are just sharing of ideas. It's not, and don't be reluctant to share just because you're not sure if the question you're raising is a valid one. This is going to be an open dialogue now. So, and certainly also, if anyone has any questions for me, this is questions and answers and discussion is what we're going to be focusing on now. So I thank you for sticking with me for that first half of the talk. And now, to me, the most exciting part is what's to come now. So we're going to open the lines, and I'll be, and when you do introduce yourself, just to help give us some perspective of who you are and where you're coming from, if you could just share your name and the organization that you're with and your state, or if for some reason those three don't apply, then at least two of those, and maybe tell us something else about you and your role. Thanks a lot, and let's open up the lines.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to make a comment or ask a question, please press star 1. Again, please clearly record your name, organization, and state. Withdraw your question or comment, you may press star 2. One moment for any questions or comments, please. And again, if you would like to ask a question, it's star, then 1.
Keep in mind, we've purposely kept everything very basic so that it would be applicable to all fields. And because these are the kinds of things that even though they may seem obvious, they often get forgotten in a real crisis. So just feel free to open up and share your thoughts and experience or questions.
Joan Broder from Stony Brook, New York, your line is open.
Thank you. Thanks very much for hosting this program. I think it's really wonderful to be disseminating this information and getting people together to talk about it. I'm wearing two hats. I'm in the Department of Psychiatry and a medical school, as well as very active in disaster relief for the American Red Cross. And one of the things that I was really glad to hear that you raised was the issue of trying to help identify the mental health resources in communities and to disseminate that information. I can tell you that as a disaster responder going into areas, mental health leads, we often spend an enormous amount of time trying to identify community mental health resources to assist us as we are triaging and trying to bring services to people. Of course, sometimes the mental health services themselves have been disabled, but a lot of times there are existing and functioning mental health services, but it is my experience that 90% of the time, even when you reach out into the community does not know who is taking the lead and who is responsible. A lot of the people that require the greatest services are those with the least resources. And so trying to organize a way for mental health responders to identify mental health resources would be enormously helpful. And even if state leads are identified, I can't imagine trying to get through on their phone line during a disaster. So I'd be real interested in hearing about existing resources for identifying that, or ideas on how we might identify it and disseminate it more.
Those are great points. And the question, how to basically identify and disseminate local resources better. And the Red Cross, thank you for all the work that you do. Of course, the Red Cross ends up being at the core of a lot of the local responses. One thing, of course, that sometimes happens is if a disaster hits a community so badly, it's possible that even the local chapter of the Red Cross could be, pretty much destabilized at that point. And so that's where the national organization of the Red Cross, they come in and help, and it's wonderful. But I think your point is good. If we just count on the state to come in and fix the problem, that won't help. Each local community needs to basically have an organization and know what the resources are too, and the idea is to link everything together. But I think you're still on the line. Before leave, did you have any suggestions as to how that might better be done, or was that more of a question for everyone?
I know that with increased preparedness efforts over the last several years, communities have been urged to identify their mental health structure in the community and what the plan of action will be. I know some communities are doing it, others probably less so. But when the disaster hits, a lot of times, of course, you've got your local mental health responding, but that tends to be insufficient. So you have a lot of people coming in who are unfamiliar with the community. And as I said in my first comment, even when my experience over and over again is even when you connect with the local mental health people, they oftentimes have no idea what the community plan is for a disaster mental health response. So it is an enormous amount of work networking, try to figure out what that is in order to deliver services. One would think that initially at a state level and then perhaps even in a national level, there could be a clearinghouse for this information. I understand it would be challenging to keep it updated, but it would be better than starting from scratch when you go into a community.
That makes sense, and that would be a good thing to suggest, I think, for us. And you raised another good point in thinking about it. You know, one of the complaints actually I've heard from states as well as local communities is, you know, when all the people just suddenly come in and overwhelm a place and don't really know about the local needs and actually don't even know sometimes about who's actually in charge, and sometimes it can create habits that way, I know. But that's a good suggestion. So I can pass that on, and I'm wondering if anyone on this call actually has further suggestions or even working on something like that, and maybe we don't realize. But I will pass that on. I will pass that suggestion on. But other comments, other callers, I thank you very much for sharing that. That's very good.
Yes. Our next line is Captain Larry Williams from the Midwest Public Health and Emergency, and he's an officer. Your line is open.
Thank you. Dr. Saffron, that was a great presentation. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you, Captain Williams.
I'm on the hands-free. I just want to pass along, my opinion is towards mental health issues, you know, you're going to have the, and I'm not sure the correct term now, you may be able to know, the worried well, they're going to show up, you know, in any kind, whether it's a biological, chemical, or a natural disaster. you're going to have the people that have, you know, the psychosomatic type symptoms that show up and just want to be seen, and then you've got the grieving that's going to go on afterwards. And in my opinion, the recovery of mental health illness is going to take longer. You know, like 9/11, people are still suffering some of the post-traumatic issues with that. So what kind of long-term, you know, we always think of immediacy here in the United States. You know, we'll get it fixed and it'll be done and over with. But, you know, when you're triaging people for actual physical illness, triaging for mental issues, is there any kind of cookbook that's been created that could help a layperson to look at, say, okay, we don't see a physical injury here. Is there some kind of stepped cookbook that could be used or created to help people to align people with the right resources? So if we know that they need, you know, a chaplain-type situation, that they could go with that. If they need mental health because their medications, like you pointed out so correctly, their medications have run out, see how we could triage them and get them to the different points that they really need to be at instead of grouping everybody for mental health issues to sit and stand in line, which would seem to me to be a waste of time. Has anything like that been created?
That's a good comment. I know that there's several different things and on several different fronts. Basically, there are various models or variations of various models that have evolved around mental health first aid and training that can be given around that. The idea being that just like we have first aid that people can learn for to do for, you know, minor cuts and bruises and more serious injuries, there also should be a form of first aid for mental health. And so there are models out there for that. There's also the issue of various organizations, the American Red Cross, the public, AMSA, and Public Health Service have each been, you know, working in trying to figure out how to better address those issues. And if you look on at least the SAMHSA website and a little bit on the CDC website, not a lot. At the SAMHSA website, I think, I don't know if the Red Cross has information now on their site. The World Health Organization at one time had some information on their site. But this is an area that's actually actively getting attention. People are actually working to bring these models out there and get people to basically be able to use them because we know that in a severe crisis, and you raised a couple of different points, actually, Captain Lewis. I mean, there was the one point that you raised about needing sort of some basic how to, you know, things to do in a crisis, and then it was also the triage issue, which actually is something that we've been working with in our Public Health Service emergency response teams, you know, preparing for how to triage in a crisis, and actually a complex issue. And we don't want to, of course. And you brought up the word well, and that's actually an interesting issue there. We have to be careful. The word well, it sounds easy, but it's actually a much more complex challenge than it would seem, because one of the problems is in an emergency, we don't always know right off the bat who really actually is experiencing severe mental health problem. I mean, we don't always know who the quote worried well are and who the people are who really, really need help. It's hard to initially know. And keep in mind, it's not like an injury to the arm where you can tell if it's bleeding or broken or not. Sometimes it's not that easy to tell on first glance and without a lot of training. So the challenge to these models is to basically try to tell people things and teach people things that they can use in these emergencies to do the best they can. But it's important not to stigmatize, and also to keep in mind that in a crisis, sometimes the confidentiality issues, you know, may still be important to people. And even though we may think, oh, it's a crisis, it's a severe emergency, and so confidentiality doesn't matter, there may be someone who's got a severe mental health issue who just isn't telling you because they're kind of keeping it to them yourself, and maybe you don't really know why they're there and why they're kind of hanging around, but maybe there's something really serious. And an example sort of on a different, actually this reminds me of a situation I once was exposed to. One in a hospital, I was on call late at night, and it was just one of these awful nights where you're up all night and it's just really tired. I'm really tired, and then at some point I heard a page overhead that they were looking to know if anyone in the hospital spoke Spanish. They needed someone who did, and then they were asking around. I was doing a consult in the ER. They were asking around, and I thought, well, my Spanish isn't, you know, the best, and they probably have someone who speaks Spanish better, but it turned out they didn't. And what they told me was, I said, sure, I'll do it. So they told me that, oh, you just need to talk to this person. It's a woman who's here to visit her husband in the emergency room, and she's just, you know, worried about him, and we're trying to tell her it's after visiting hours, and she needs to go home. And I guess they were saying her husband was in the hospital, was admitted somewhere or whatever, and she was in the emergency room trying to get to see her husband, and they wanted me to basically explain that she'll have to come back tomorrow or something like that. And they said she only speaks Spanish. So I started talking to her, and what it turned out was that, and this is, turned out that she actually was not there because she wanted to visit her husband in the hospital. She was there because she had been beaten by her husband, and she was concerned. I mean, she was basically injured and beaten by her husband, and she had nowhere to go, and she was there seeking help in the emergency room. And they were just basically labeling her as just this person who was just worried about her husband and needed to just be told to go home and come back in the morning. So my point in bringing that up is that we always have to be careful about who we label the word well. But on the other hand, it is true that if we don't have a good triage system and we basically we only have limited resources in emergency, there are a lot of people that will come that don't really need help. We need to figure out who does and who doesn't. So I'm kind of long-winded answer, but your points are really good, and hopefully we'll get better at this in the future.
Am I still on?
Yeah, you are, Captain Williams.
I just want to ask one last thing, and I don't know this. Does the SNS, the Strategic National Stockpile, do you know if they're stocking any medications, anxiety relief, you know, antidepressant, anxiety relief, you know, like a Xanax-type situation that, you know, in a mass situation, you could well imagine some people are going to need to be calmed down. Do you know if those are being stockpiled?
That's a really good question. I actually once, a long time ago, knew the answer to that, and I actually don't know. So that's actually a good thing that I need to find out. I don't know, and I will find out for you. And if there's a way that...
If the inquirer can just send an email to coca@cdc.gov, coca@cdc.gov, we'll coordinate with Dr. Safran and get that answer for you.
Yes,
I really. My job, I'm the public health emergency officer for the 16-state Navy region here in the Midwest, and we're really coordinating a lot with pandemic influenza, possibly outbreaks, and other public health issues that could arise. And you know, in the event of a natural man-made or terrorist disaster. And all these issues are just bubbling around with mental health aspects of it. So your comments and everything have been very much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Captain Williams. And see, that's a good example how here even, I don't even know what the exact psychotropic meds that we have in our stockpile right now. And so it shows you all of us can, there can be things that we don't know. So we need to, that's part of the point of this call, is to get us to think about those and that we will know in a real crisis. So thank you again for that, Captain Williams. The next question, caller?
It comes from Paul Daigman of New Hampshire, Disaster Behavior Health Coordinator. Your line is open.
Thank you, and I appreciate your presentation today, Dr. Safran. I represent disaster behavioral health coordinators. There's one of us in every state, and when I say I represent, I think we're all different and unique in our own ways, from being, you know, part-time to full-time, different sources of funding, but different locations. I myself am located in the Department of Safety, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. Most of my counterparts are in either public health or behavioral health. We were, some have been around for many years and others are fairly new. SAMHSA initiated through a capacity enhancement grant the development of 35 systems around the country after the events of 9/11. And typically I think we see our role is to respond to certainly the large-scale events like terrorism-related events or bioterrorism threats, natural disasters, but even smaller-scale incidents, as you pointed out, a single death of a child in a school can have ramifications and impact so many different people. We really partner with, I think, local responses, which typically, whether that's a hospital or a school system or a city or town, aren't built to manage the behavioral health response to a community's needs because it's very expensive too, and typically they need resources beyond their own, and a lot of local responders might be impacted by the event themselves, so they are victims or survivors in their own way. So this is where state resources, and in some cases where there's a presidentially declared disaster through FEMA, federal resources. In our state, we have about over 650 behavioral health professionals who have volunteered to respond to disasters, and we typically partner with some of those groups you mentioned, Red Cross, community mental health centers, other existing critical incident stress debriefing teams, behavioral staff from schools and hospitals, and when we're requested by a local municipality to offer assistance through these volunteer teams, we do. And so far, it's been a win-win relationship, I think, for our team members who want to contribute to the recovery of their communities as well as for the communities to be able to receive outside help. So in a nutshell, that's sort of what it is. We do get a lot of support from SAMHSA DTAC. And if you want to know who the state coordinator is, if you go to the SAMHSA DTAC website, there's a list of the contact information for the disaster behavioral health coordinators in every state.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming on this call to share that. And everyone, you do have that slide with the DTAC web address in your slide packet. And I recommend that all of you look at that and find out what it is that that your state coordinator is doing around behavioral health and how you might relate to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yes, Diana Nordbrow of Virginia Department of Mental Health.
Hi, can you hear me? Hello, Dr. Safran?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi,
very
great.
Well, thank you.
This is Diana Nordbrow, and I am also with the Virginia Department of Mental Health, and I manage the 9/11 mental health response to terrorist attack on the Pentagon. And I'd just like to say ditto to my friend from New Hampshire, because I was calling in to make the same point, that it's really important for people to understand that under the National Response Framework, there is a system in place to deliver disaster behavioral health services, and it does come from the state and local mental health authorities. And many of the states are now developing volunteer cadres or trying to find better mechanisms for coordinating volunteers. So it's really important for people who want to participate in the response to be coordinated with these agencies who do have the legal responsibility to respond. And again, and I'd like to thank you very much for all the great publications CDC has produced on disaster behavioral health since 9/11. In Virginia, we have relied on a lot of those publications, and we have developed a lot of our own for our state. And I recommend anybody listening to go to their state websites, because they'll probably find their state has also developed a lot of disaster behavioral health materials that have been adapted from CDC and SAMHSA materials specifically for their state.
Thank you very much. And can I ask you one question while I have you on the line? This is very helpful. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you think of as a state mental health coordinator, is there one, if you were going to share one suggestion with folks out in the field who are trying to prepare their, basically how to be ready for a disaster and how to consider mental health, is other than knowing who their state coordinator is and knowing who the other players are, is there one other thing that we might have missed in this call that maybe you can think of that you'd want to tell them also?
I'm a consultant. I work for the state coordinator, who's Beth Nelson. The best thing for anybody to be prepared is to get some basic information. And again, there's a lot of great trainings already developed, and I would start with their state coordinator to find out which trainings would be best for their community. And I would start, helping get themselves trained, because there's plenty of free material out there, and we should all be sharing these resources.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next question.
This is from Jane Bishop of Pennsylvania, Office of Mental Health.
Jane, thank you very much for calling us.
Thank you for sponsoring this training and for your willingness to dialogue about what the disaster mental health coordinators do in each of the states and for including us in your slide. I think it's important for folks to know that everybody's going to be needed when there's a large-scale disaster, and the importance of knowing what's already in place is vital so that it prevents the conversion of spontaneous volunteers. A lot of times people want to help, and they show up, and then they don't know what to do. So I think having a call like this enables people to have some ideas on where to start. And I would start with the disaster mental health coordinators in each of the states. And they work with their state emergency management agency and their state department of health, their state homeland security departments. And all these things are critical to build a framework that then fits into the national response framework. But everybody's needed, and I think, you know, the captain asked, had some really good questions about what's in place and what can be done, and I think there's a lot of resources, again, on the SAMHSA website, the CDC website, knowing that people have normal reactions, that the reactions are normal to these abnormal situations for the most part, and how to help them understand that. So those are the kinds of things we do at the state level as we build a volunteer system of response. There's a number of other things that you'll learn about as when you look at mental health consumers in our state. We're training mental health consumers to be on our disaster mental health response teams because, as one of them said to me, Jane, I know where to get a cup of coffee when nobody else does. So we're working with all different kinds of agencies to try to get people to look at what their medication issues might be if there's a large-scale disaster. We're working with special populations in terms of trying to get them ready to prepare for disasters. So there's a lot of work going on at the state level that includes the county and the local mental health response. I know the first questioner asked, you know, about those kinds of community mental health resources. So there's a lot going on, and probably the best way to link and find out is and you'll also be able to tap into some resources if you do that. I think that's all I probably have to say for right now.
Thank you very much, and I really do appreciate that you and the other coordinators who actually came together to help me put together those bullets on that slide, and I thank you for that, the one about the states, and just want to say that we're only going to have time for maybe one more question, but before we go to that last question, I just want to say that there are a lot, this call was just meant to touch on the surface, of this, and to get everyone motivated to move forward and start to think about this more and plan further. Also, keep in mind one other thing, I don't think it was mentioned in this call, but keep in mind that, as Jane mentioned, it's important to realize that many responses to a disaster that may seem pathological actually might be normal responses, and it's important, that's why it's important to have good training and to kind of be able to understand the difference, and also to understand that just because something is called mental health help, it's not always the right kind, and it's important that we have good, you know, quality, appropriate mental health assistance in disasters, and that we not, you know, do things that might actually re-traumatize people or harm them more. So I don't want to scare anyone, you know, away from trying to do good things, but just keep in mind that there are risks and benefits to everything we do. So this isn't as easy and, you know, as it always seems. But let me take one more caller, I think, one more question or comment.
I'm from Dr. Marcia Epstein with Los Angeles Department of Public Health.
Dr. Epstein?
Hi. Thank you so much. This has been really good. We've been working, I'm in chronic disease prevention, so we've been working with our emergency preparedness unit to work on medication availability afterward. But also, I had been on a disaster medical assistance team that saw no need for any mental health issues to be addressed by them. So I think it needs to be an integral part of the disaster medical assistance teams, and also the national NIMS, National Incident Management System. I don't remember anything on mental health in there. And so it really needs to be put into the incident command system at all levels. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those comments. And we just basically need to build, I think, mental health into all of our country's emergency preparedness for all emergencies and for any type of crisis, whether it's small or large. It's the time of leaving mental health out and thinking of mental health as just some separate thing. It's just not a time that we're in anymore. It's not a we can't afford to do that. We have to address mental health. So I thank you all for taking the time to participate in this call, and I want to just encourage everyone to do good things to help build mental health into your plans for future response to whatever crises or disasters we may encounter in the future.
Well, Dr. Saffron, thank you so much for providing our listeners with this information and for this fruitful discussion. I'd also like to thank our participants for joining us today. In case you didn't get the chance to ask your question, please send an email to coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov, and we will coordinate with Dr. Saffron to get you answers to your questions. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next week. You have 1 year to obtain continuing education credits for this call. All continuing education credits for COCA conference calls are issued online through the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System, www.cdc.gov/TCEonline. Thank you again for participating today, and have a wonderful day.